Hello and welcome to the People and Culture Podcast, a program dedicated to exploring topical and emerging issues impacting on the world of work. I'm your host, James Judge. Today on the People and Culture Podcast, I'm very happy to be speaking via Skype with Gabrielle Sullivan. Gabrielle is Director, Employment and Industrial Law at Bradley Allen Love Lawyers in Canberra. Gabrielle, thanks for making the time to talk today.
Thanks, James. You're welcome.
Gabrielle, as I mentioned in the intro, you're currently Director of the Employment and Industrial Law Practice at Bradley Allen Love. What sort of matters do you typically deal with, and what does a practice look like?
James, we deal with the whole gamut of employment and industrial law matters at Bradley Allen Love, from kind of hiring, firing, to everything in between. We act for employers, we act for employees, so we're not particularly aligned to either side of the employee-employer divide, as it were. We act for the public sector, so Commonwealth, we act for the ACT government on occasion, we can act for New South Wales local councils, and we act for private sector employees and employers as well, so small, medium enterprises operating largely in Canberra, but sometimes outside of it.
So, Gabrielle, we first met some years ago. We were both working at the University of Sydney. I think you had just finished law there when I started. It was then what was then ACERT, which became the Workplace Research Centre. Out of all the different types of legal practice, what attracted you specifically to employment and industrial law?
That's going back a few years, James.
It is.
But I suppose it's the drama of it all. I mean, employment law, and particularly industrial law, is very politicised in Australia. And I can remember at university realising for the first time that there was really at least two sides to every story, and possibly more, depending largely on your point of view. So that's what attracted me initially. And I suppose now what keeps me motivated today is really the humanity of it all, because work is really about getting the best out of people, and labour law and employment law is really supposed to support that outcome. And let's be frank, getting the best out of people is really quite a tricky endeavour. So that's where I am at the moment.
You mentioned before that, being based in Canberra, you deal with a number of matters involving public sector employees. I wanted to ask you about a couple of things that I think are noticeable in relation to how the public sector generally, and I stress that this is a generalisation, deals with particular employment-related matters. Let's start with performance management. Things often seem to go from zero to 100 pretty quickly, and by that I mean what would look to me like an initial performance management issue winds up being treated as a code of conduct matter. Would you agree with that?
Would I agree with that? I'd probably nuance it a little bit more. Certainly what I see in my practice is lots of problems with performance management and conduct management in both the APS and the ACTPS. There's no doubt about that from where I sit. Obviously, I only see problematic workplaces, James, in this respect, but I think it's a definite key issues, those two issues. I'd say they're separate issues, performance management and conduct management. Well, they should be. What I see is a lot of confusion between the two. But in terms of the speed with which matters can escalate, I suppose what I would say is with performance management, what I actually see, and I think what a lot of citizens see, is that the APS can be slow to performance manage when it's legitimately warranted. It can actually be quite slow. Why? I suppose the perception is that the process is difficult to performance management people, and I think managers feel that they won't be acknowledged for their efforts in this regard. So they're slow to performance manage, and I suppose also to performance manage requires effort and to some extent conflict it's not a nice job to have to do. So there's, to the extent a manager has a natural tendency to avoid conflict, then underperformance is allowed to continue. So what I see is the APS being slow to performance manage when they should be performance managing. On the other hand, which is what I think you're getting to, I do see them being quite swift to move when they've decided that a particular public servant needs to go. What I see there, though, is rather than invoking the performance management process to deal with any perceived underperformance, what I see is that the weapon of choice tends to be the code of conduct. So they'll allege that the employee is misconducting themselves. And in that process can be invoked swiftly. It tends to take a long time to be concluded, but I'm seeing some very poor decision making in the misconduct management space.
That's a far more subtle way of putting it, and a much better way of putting it than the way I had framed it. So you're saying performance management is a separate issue from code of conduct. They tend to get confused, and in fact it's the lack of speed in sometimes implementing a robust performance management process that can then lead, you know, when the decision's made to take action, it can end up potentially as a misconduct matter.
The difference between performance and conduct is quite simple. It's the sort of can't cook versus won't cook type analogy.
Right.
If you're just not good at your job, then performance management is the process that should be considered. If you're naughty, allegedly, then it's a misconduct issue. They're conceptually quite distinct. What I see, though, is a blurring of the two. And look, there are occasions where they're linked. There is a link between the two. But I think the difference needs to be much more widely understood by HR managers who are invoking these processes on their staff that are hugely disconcerting for staff. If the wrong process is invoked, it's a huge thing for the staff member to defend themselves, as it were, against the machine and the sort of bureaucratic inanity that then ensues from having a process wrongly invoked. It should be a simple thing to correct, but trust me, it is not.
Bureaucratic inanity, let's say. An interesting way of putting it.
Well, perhaps a little strong, James, but like I said to you, we only see problematic workplaces. So I'm sure there's plenty of very, very sound bureaucratic decision-making going on in Canberra. But when it goes wrong, and these decisions are made generally by HR managers and going up as high as the corporate, the COO level, I do see some pretty spectacularly, inane decisions, and spectacularly unfair decisions being made, and it takes a lot of legal fortitude to correct those decisions because there's a profound reluctance once they've committed to a course to change that course, even when it's patently clear that that should happen. So it can take months and months and months to get a sort of whoops type admission.
Bullying and harassment, again, it's a separate issue. Probably fits more on the code of conduct side, but it typically receives a lot of attention in most public sector workplaces. There is certainly a lot of visibility around the issue. If you go into a tea room, you'll see posters on the subject. If you look at any agency annual training calendar, you'll see there's normally courses on avoiding or preventing bullying and harassment. Agencies, ACT government has the RED framework, Respect, Equity and Diversity Framework, and most state governments or state government agencies and federal governments have something similar, contact officers. Yet there are some workplaces that I know of where those clearly guilty of serial bullying, which I would see as genuine and serious misconduct, get away with it. What could agencies be doing differently, do you think?
Good question. I mean, I certainly agree with you that I see a lot of low-level bullying complaints getting a fair bit of airtime, and but then I, as you say, I'm aware of much more serious and systemic complaints seemingly unaddressed. So that's the irony of where bullying sitting for me. In terms of solutions, though, because your question was, well, what do we do about it? As I was saying before, it helps if we know what we're talking about. So to say I'm being subjected to workplace bullying is a statement of conclusion, right? It's not a statement of the facts that make up that conclusion. And I'm sorry to be a bit of a lawyer about it, James, but it's such an easy word to throw around, but we need to know the content of what the bullying is before we can understand the solution. Because as I was saying before, it's almost become, you know, to say that you're a bully, it somehow proves it or makes it so. Obviously, there's a lot that needs to be unpacked to understand what is the nature of the complaint. So who, what, where, when type stuff. Particulars of what the bullying is need to be understood. And then when you understand what the problem, the actual content of the bullying is, and you have a look at where it's occurring, then you're a lot closer to finding a solution. In my practice, what I see is a lot of campus-type environments tend to struggle with workplace bullying as a more endemic problem. So there's obviously some culture issues going on there that need to be seriously looked at. So I guess I'm not being very helpful, but I'm saying that it's quite specific. The solution to the problem is going to be as specific as the nature of the bullying that's occurring. So you have to go to that level of trouble to understand the problem to try and solve it. That's from a lawyer's point of view. I guess I'd say more generally, though, that ultimately respectful and reasonable behaviours are modelled from the top. And they're modelled from the top down. So if your senior management has the bandwidth or the scope to be respectful, if they have the scope to be reasonable, then you're much more likely to foster a workplace that's respectful and reasonable. If they're under pressure or they are unable for whatever reason to model those behaviours, then it's pretty unlikely that it's going to filter down. So that's not really a lawyer's perspective. That's just my personal view. So some work needs to happen at the top to make sure the senior managers have actually got the space to operate in that sort of manner. And then as for specific allegations on the workplace floor, I really think they need to be unpacked professionally and then addressed professionally. And I do think you can turn culture around. You can. I've seen it happen. It just takes a bit of will.
You mentioned campus-type environments earlier. Do you want to just explain what you mean by that? You're not talking about university workplaces, are you, specifically?
I think I wouldn't be telling anybody anything they didn't know to say that health, hospital-type campuses and in the health and medical professions seem to, both in the ACT and across New South Wales, I believe, and quite other Australian jurisdictions, there seems to be a lot of allegations of workplace bullying in hospitals, universities, those sort of environments where staff are really committed to life, as it were, to that working environment. That's just what I kind of see. I'd like to see some numbers around that, but certainly in my practice, those sort of work environments really dominate a lot of the workplace bullying and harassment complaints. Whether there's something particular about the practice of medicine or the way hospitals operate that leads to perceptions of bullying and harassment, I'm not quite sure. I'm sure there's better minds than mine been working on that question, but I'm simply saying there's something about a long-term working environment that can breed discontent and allegations of bullying and harassment. And probably should also say, to be fair, that not every allegation of bullying and harassment is, on proper analysis, found to be that. So there are plenty, there's a difference between being unhappy at work from being bullied at work, and I'm not sure that everybody appreciates the difference.
It's interesting, the healthcare sector and your observation around the prevalence of these issues. I've done a bit of work in that area, and I sort of describe it as a perfect storm. You've got shift work, you've got hierarchies, you've got sick people and dying people, you've got unlimited needs chasing limited budgets.
Correct. I suspect these factors do not help.
They don't help. But as the old saying goes, the fish rots from the head. Have you heard that one?
Well, I have heard it, and I guess that's what I was – I'm inclined to agree with it just as a not as a lawyer, but just as a person. As I was saying to you, I suspect that it's a leadership issue, and that, you know, I was saying, is to the extent that good behaviours are modelled from the top down, then it's, as I was saying, it's more likely that those behaviours will permeate the culture of the organisation, and you know, everybody sinks or swims together, to use the fish analogy.
Extend the fish analogy. Another topic that seems a perennial focus of public service commissions and human resource practitioners in various public services is unscheduled absences. Any comments on this?
Oh, tricky issue. I'd like to have a look at the numbers on it. Perhaps the State of the Service report or something might be a good place to have a look. I haven't looked there recently. But, look, I suspect Australians are far more hardworking and take less unscheduled absences than the public suspects they do. I suspect it's a small few that engage in that sort of behaviour. And then the question is, what's the reason for the absence? So I guess I would say, as a lawyer, look, these situations can and should be managed on a case-by-case basis using whatever lawful tools are available. And quite often, as we probably can intuit, that unscheduled absences can be a symptom of a bigger problem or a bigger malaise at work. It might be a symptom of a bigger malaise at home, but it may well be reflect a lack of engagement at work, those sort of more difficult issues. But from a legal perspective, they can be managed to an extent and should be managed. There's some tools available to manage those if they are problematic for an agency.
The Federal Public Service Commissioner, John Lloyd, put out some policy and guidance a little while ago, talked about wage restraint, capping public service wage rises at 2% per annum, also advising public service management that they do not need to make collective agreements. And there was some other stuff in there around relevant to casualisation of the workforce. The ACTU subsequently put out a press release entitled "Turnbull Attacks Own Workforce with Regressive Bargaining Policy." Is that a fair call, do you think?
Well, perhaps I could answer it this way. What could I say? What I see in my practice on a day-to-day basis is there is a noticeable disparity of income and entitlements between my public sector clients and my private sector clients generally. I mean, obviously one needs to compare apples with apples, but I'd just say it's pretty obvious to me before I even speak to a person that there'll be a disparity in entitlement simply based on whether in the public or the private sector. So that's just an observation I make as a lawyer sitting in Canberra across both sides of public and private practice. With respect to the enterprise bargaining process, I'm not really sure that anyone thinks that the way the enterprise bargaining process in the APS currently works is a good idea. I mean, I stand to be corrected, but from what I can see, everybody thinks that it's slow, it's pretty painful, and it's time-consuming. So I'm not quite sure where you would take it, but I definitely think there's room for improvement in the way wages are managed for the APS.
Last month, Fair Work Commission suspended proposed industrial action by a couple of unions after suspension orders were requested under Section 424 of the Fair Work Act by, I think there were two parties actually to that application, and that part of the Act talks about the Commission suspending or terminating industrial action if it threatens to endanger life, personal safety or health, or the welfare of the population or part of the population, or if it threatens to cause significant damage to the economy. Do you think actions like strikes and even things like overtime bans are now problematic across a whole lot of industries and sectors?
I think that there's a lot of constraints on engaging in industrial action in Australia at the moment, and they have been in place for quite some time. As for this particular decision and this particular constraint, can I say I haven't read the decision, but I will go and read it, but I'm familiar with how it's supposed to operate. What I could say is that decisions in the Fair Work Commission are supposed to turn on their facts, and it's the application of the test that's in the Fair Work Act to the particular facts by members of the tribunal, independent members of the Fair Work Commission. Right? So that's the job, that's what they're supposed to be doing. To my knowledge, that particular power has been exercised very sparingly to date by those tribunal members. As far as I'm aware, there's only a couple of decisions where that power has been exercised. Obviously, this is one in that in relation to that power. But I guess what I'm saying is that it's not something new as such. That power has always been it's been around for many years. It's been invoked sparingly, and it should depend upon the proper application of the particular facts to that broader, shall we say, public interest test that Parliament, in its wisdom, has chosen to enact. So that's the sort of boring legal answer. And as I said, more generally, it's getting pretty hard to engage in lawful industrial action in Australia, and I really think that because of that the amount of industrial action really is on the way down in Australia.
Gabrielle, thanks for joining us today on the People and Culture podcast.
You're very welcome, James. A pleasure.
You've been listening to the People and Culture Podcast with me, James Judge. If you want to make a comment or have suggestions for future shows, feel free to email me, jjudge@themandarin.com.au. Thanks for listening.